Chapter one, take two, do.
Nice.
I enjoy watching the flights of birds on Arrakis, the banker said, directing his words at Jessica. All of our birds, of course, are carrion eaters, and many exist without water, having become blood drinkers. The stillsuit manufacturer's daughter, seated between Paul and his father at the other end of the table, twisted her pretty face into a frown and said, "Oh, Susu, you say the most disgusting things." The banker smiled. "They call me Susu because I'm financial advisor to the Water Peddlers Union." And as Jessica continued to look at him without comment, he added, "Because of the water seller's cry. S-s-sook!" And he imitated the call with such accuracy that many around the table laughed. Jessica heard the boastful tone of voice, but noted most that the young woman had spoken on cue, a set piece. She had produced the excuse for the banker to say what he had said. She glanced at Lingar Butte. The water magnate was scowling, concentrating on his dinner. It came to Jessica that the banker had said, "I, too, control that ultimate source of power on Arrakis. Water." Paul had marked the falseness in his dinner companion's voice, saw that his mother was following the conversation with Bene Gesserit intensity. On impulse, he decided to play the foil, draw the exchange out. He addressed himself to the banker. "Do you mean to say, sir, that these birds are cannibals?"
"That's an odd question, young master," said the banker. "I merely said the birds drink blood. It doesn't have to be the blood of their own kind, does it?"
"It was not an odd question," Paul said, and Jessica noted the brittle riposte quality of her training exposed in his voice. Most educated people know that the worst potential competition for any young organism can come from its own kind. He deliberately forked a bite of food from his companion's plate and ate it. "They are eating from the same bowl. They have the same basic requirements." The banker stiffened, scowled at the Duke.
"Do not make the error of considering my son a child," the Duke said, and he smiled.
Jessica glanced around the table, noted that Butte had brightened, that both Kynes and the smuggler Tuic were grinning.
"It's a rule of ecology," Kynes said, "that the young master appears to understand quite well. The struggle between life's elements is the struggle for the free energy of a system. Blood's an efficient energy source."
The banker put down his fork, spoke in an angry voice.
"It's said that the freemen scum drink the blood of their dead."
Kynes shook his head, spoke in a lecturing tone.
"Not the blood, sir, but all of the man's water ultimately belongs to his people, to his tribe. It's a necessity when you live near the Great Flat. All water's precious there, and the human body is composed of some 70% water by weight. A dead man surely no longer requires that water."
The banker put both hands against the table beside his plate, and Jessica thought he was going to push himself back, leave in a rage. Kynes looked at Jessica.
"Forgive me, my lady, for elaborating on such an ugly subject at table, but you were being told falsehood, and it needed clarifying."
"You've associated so long with the Fremen that you've lost all sensibilities," the banker rasped.
Kynes looked at him calmly, studied the pale, trembling face.
"Are you challenging me, sir?"
The banker froze. He swallowed, spoke stiffly.
"Of course not. I'd not so insult our host and hostess."
Jessica heard the fear in the man's voice, saw it in his face, in his breathing, in the pulse of a vein at his temple. The man was terrified of Kynes.
"Our host and hostess are quite capable of deciding for themselves when they've been insulted," Kynes said. "They're brave people who understand defensive honor. We all may attest to their courage by the fact that they are here. Now. On Arrakis."
Jessica saw that Leto was enjoying this. Most of the others were not. People all around the table sat poised for flight, hands out of sight under the table. Two notable exceptions were Butte, who was openly smiling at the banker's discomfiture, and the smuggler, Tuic, who appeared to be watching Kynes for a cue. Jessica saw that Paul was looking at Kynes in admiration.
"Well," Kynes said.
"I meant no offense," the baker muttered. "If offense was taken, please accept my apologies."
"Freely given, freely accepted," Kynes said.
He smiled at Jessica, resumed eating as though nothing had happened. Jessica saw that the smuggler, too, had relaxed. She marked this. The man had shown every aspect of an aide ready to leap to Kynes' assistance. There existed an accord of some sort between Kynes and Tuic. Leto toyed with a fork, looked speculatively at Kynes. The ecologist's manner indicated a change in attitude toward the House of Atreides. Kynes had seemed colder on their trip over the desert. Jessica signaled for another course of food and drink. Servants appeared with Servants appeared with red wine and a sauce of mushroom yeast on the side. Slowly the dinner conversation resumed, but Jessica heard the agitation in it, the brittle quality, saw that the banker ate in sullen silence. Kynes would have killed him without hesitating, she thought, and she realized that there was an offhand attitude towards killing in Kynes' manner. He was a casual killer, and she guessed that this was a Fremen quality. Jessica turned to the stillsuit manufacturer on her left and said, "I find myself continually amazed by the importance of water on Arrakis." "Very important," he agreed. "What is this dish? It's delicious." "Tongues of wild rabbit and a special sauce," she said. "A very old recipe."
"I must have that recipe," the man said.
She nodded. "I'll see that you get it." Kynes looked at Jessica and said, "The newcomer to Arrakis frequently underestimates the importance of water here. You are dealing, you see, with the law of the minimum." She heard the testing quality in his voice and said, "Growth is limited by that necessity which is present in the least amount, and naturally the least favorable condition controls the growth rate." "It's rare to find members of a great house aware of the planetological problems," Kynes said. "Water is the least favorable condition for life on Arrakis, and remember that growth itself can produce unfavorable conditions unless treated with extreme care." Jessica sensed a hidden message in Kynes' words, but knew she was missing it. "Growth," she said. "Do you mean Arrakis can have an orderly cycle of water to sustain human life under more favorable conditions?"
"Impossible!" the water magnate barked.
Jessica turned her attention to Butte.
"Impossible?"
"Impossible on Arrakis," he said. "Don't listen to this dreamer. All the laboratory evidence is against him."
Kynes looked at Butte, and Jessica noted that the other conversations around the table had stopped while people concentrated on this new interchange.
"Laboratory evidence tends to blind us to a very simple fact," Kynes said. "That fact is this. We are dealing here with the matters that originated and exist out of doors where plants and animals carry on their normal existence."
"Normal," Butte snorted. "Nothing about Arrakis is normal."
"Quite the contrary," Kynes said. "Certain harmonies could be set up here along self-sustaining lines. You merely have to understand the limits of the planet and the pressures upon it."
"It'll never be done," Butte said.
The Duke came to a sudden realization, placing the point where Kynes' attitude had changed. It had been when Jessica had spoken of holding the conservatory plants in trust for Arrakis.
"What would it take to set up a self-sustaining system, Dr. Kynes?" Leto asked.
"If we can get 3% of the green planet elements on Arrakis involved in forming carbon compounds as foodstuffs, we've started the cyclic system," Kynes said.
"Water's the only problem?" the Duke asked.
He sensed Kynes' excitement, felt himself caught up in it.
"Water overshadows the other problems," Kynes said. "This planet has much oxygen without its usual concomitants. Widespread plant life and large sources of free carbon dioxide from such phenomena as volcanoes. There are unusual chemical interchanges over large surfaces of area here."
"Do you have pilot projects?"
The Deuce asked.
The
Duke asked. "We've had a long time in which to build up the Tansley effect, small unit experiments on an amateur basis from which my science may now draw its working facts," Kynes said.
"There isn't enough water," Butte said. "There just isn't enough water."
"Master Butte is an expert on water," Kynes said. He smiled, turned back to his dinner. The Duke gestured sharply down with his right hand, and barked.
"No! I want an answer. Is there enough water, Dr. Kynes?"
Kynes stared at his plate. Jessica watched the play of emotion on his face. He masks himself well, she thought, but she had him registered now and read that he regretted his words.
"Is there enough water?" the Duke demanded.
"There may be," Kynes said. "He's faking uncertainty," Jessica thought.
With his deeper truth sense, Paul caught the underlying motive, had to use every ounce of his training to mask his excitement. "There is enough water, but Kynes doesn't wish it to be known."
I know that was a super long passage.
Yeah, but I know why you read it.
Oh, good.
Thank you so much, honey. I know that was a long bit. I
really enjoyed it.
Not in like a mockery.
It's fun to do the voices.
Yeah, not in like a mockery way, but I'd really love to play you back you saying Fremen. Because I was like, I know she knows it's Fremen.
I pronounced it as Fremen in my brain for ages, even though there aren't two A's.
are two E's. Yep. But it's because, like, in my mind, they should be free men.
Because they should be free?
Men, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I got that. Kia ora koutou, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Chapter 1, Take 2, a podcast where we read a book, watch a film, and discuss the adaptation. My name is Maddie.
My name is Brianna.
And we are finally doing our 2021 Dune episode, following on from our David Lynch 1984 episode we had at Little Andromeda. Brianna, who was the director of this film?
Denis Villeneuve.
Mm. Wonderful. Also director of many big blockbusters.
Arrival.
Yes.
And Blade Runner 2049.
And also, because with an S, and it has the same actor in it.
Sicario!
Very good. I have a really funny memory related to Sicario, because it's such an intense film, but the night that we watched it, Mum had asked my brother to put on a comedy, and then Cameron put on The Room. Which is funny as heck.
Yeah.
Like, it's really funny. But it wasn't the vibe that people were wanting of the night. And then he put on Sicario and everyone was, like, enthralled. And it was quite late by that point because they couldn't decide on a movie. And he was like, this isn't a comedy. Like, mm-hmm. But you guys wouldn't pick. And then the guests we had over for dinner had to leave halfway through the movie because it was so late. But everyone was like...
Yeah, it was a good movie.
Yeah, it was a good movie. But I associate, like... Like, my brother was trying to please my mum and put on a comedy, but then he's like, I know they'll like this movie. I'll just put it on so I could leave.
Well, it is hard to please everyone.
It is hard to please everyone.
As the Duke finds out.
Absolutely. So, obviously, some major things. This is just part one.
Yes.
So there's going to be a second part released, probably not till 2023.
Yeah.
Is what I believe.
Yeah.
This stars Timothy Chalamet as Paul Atreides.
Timothy Chalamet.
Chalamet?
Chalamet, not Chalamet.
Chalamet!
And Zendaya, one word.
Zendaya?
Zendaya.
As Chani. Beautiful Chani. Something right off the bat that I love much more than the 1984 version is the diversity of the cast. Obviously, racially, there are more people of colour in this Dune adaptation, as there absolutely would be, because if you lived in a desert, as in Earth, when you live on Earth, often if you live on a desert, not always the case, but the sun has, you know, what's the melatonin?
Pigment,
but it's melatonin in your skin? Yeah, it's made your skin darker.
Also, I mean, the culture of Dune is...
Arrakis. It is Arrakis, the Dune plane.
It's both. Arrakis and Dune.
Everything has multiple names.
Yeah, there's just, you know, keep it all straight.
Yeah.
The culture is largely based, like the book is largely based on the conflict between the Middle East for oil and other countries trying to exploit it.
Yeah.
So.
That's what Frank Herbert was basing it on when he wrote it.
So again, not white people. Necessarily.
No, not white people. And also, you know, disregarding what I said before, just in the world, regardless of where you live, there are POC, but just multinationals, ethnicities everywhere.
Yeah.
You know. But no, I 2.5 hours is a long film.
But it's super engaging. I think we were kind of putting off rewatching it because it's 2.5 hours and we put it off until like the last possible second. But like, I was still captivated.
Yeah. No, I remember thinking we watched it again just to, you know, why not? But also in the cinema, I remember thinking like...
We've been comfort watching Charmed, the OG.
Yeah. It's been great. We're into season 5 now. We just watched the third episode of season 5.
Yeah. Crush it.
Yeah. I saw a little sneak peek on a thumbnail or something coming up and I was like, ooh! I didn't think it dragged on at all in the cinema. I remember being like, oh, I really enjoy the detail that this is going into. And, you know, that's the thing, isn't it? When films are split into two or more parts for financial gain, it's often very obvious. Prime example from my perspective is when they made The Hobbit, which is an incredibly short book into three feature-length films trying to do what they did with Lord of the Rings, which is a series, and it just fell really flat. Yeah. Like, I found The Hobbit incredibly boring, whereas Dune is a dense piece of literature that just throws you right in to the universe from the get-go. So splitting it into two parts makes absolute sense because there's so much content to go through.
Yeah, it's interesting because obviously there was all that voiceover narration in the 1984 version, which it's iconic in a terrible adaptation.
It's fun for what it is. But does that context at the beginning really matter? Like, it doesn't...
No. But what I was saying, that's exactly what I was saying. So there's, definitely way fewer lines in Denis Villeneuve's version. But you still get it.
Totally.
You get what's happening.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty easy for us to all imagine. Like, we live in a world here on Earth which has political dynamics. Like, people fighting each other over power. Like, different... you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's not hard for us to grasp.
There's only a few key points that you need to understand to be able to understand kind of what's happening. So there's House Atreides and House Harkonnen, and Harkonnen used to have Dune, but the Emperor has decided to give it to House Atreides,
maliciously.
Maliciously, because it's a trap, and that's because he feels threatened by the Atreides house.
Yep, and
so
you know,
he helps House Harkonnen set up the trap by giving soldiers to it.
Yeah.
And then the other big thing is that there's this question around whether or not Paul is the Kwisatz Haderach, because Jessica was supposed to produce a girl because they have that ability in the Bene Gesserit.
Yes.
Supposed to produce a girl, didn't produce
a
boy.
To choose the gender of their child.
And one of the ways that the mother
watched it.
Reverend Mother.
Yes.
Yeah. What she says is, we've prepared the way for you as best as we can. And what that means is that they've been laying stories of the Kwisatz Haderach, legends, prophecies on Dune for generations, so that if Paul is the Kwisatz Haderach, he can use that and then they will protect him.
Yeah.
And that's what he does at the end.
It's an interesting situation.
But that's basically it.
Yeah, no, that is it. You're absolutely right. You've just rewritten Dune very efficiently. It's kind of a, you know, what happened first situation, or is it just...
It would be funny. Can we do a one-sentence summary of Dune? We did that last time, didn't we?
Yeah, but it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. But one other thing I wanted to say when you were doing your brief summary was that we know that the Harkonnens are bad because they're ugly, and the... Atreides are good because they're all very pretty.
Yeah, that's true.
And they don't have ugly pets. Although we miss the pugs in this one. There are no pugs.
And cats.
No, but there are weird...
spider things.
Human hand things. Yes. Okay, yeah, yep. Terrifying. Go for your one sentence. Bugsy's playing with a ping pong ball.
Emo boy entranced by over-the-shoulder girl gets lost in desert and learns to dance.
And learns to dance. Love it. Lots of white men fighting over power, abusing people of color, and destroying the natural resources of a planet.
It was sadder.
Still true.
It's
sad.
Yeah, what was
that? True.
They
come flocking to my cauldron.
What was I saying the other day? Like, Pocahontas, white men learns that colonization is bad. Avatar, white man learns that colonization is bad.
In space. Yeah.
That's
exactly what it is.
Dune, white man learns that colonization is bad. In the desert.
They're all the same story. But we never learn the lesson.
Okay, so differences.
Differences.
First of all, how would you rate it as an adaptation of the first half of Dune?
7.5.
Oh, interesting. I would say that's quite low.
I was thinking between 5 to 8 because I can't really remember. It's been a long time since I read the book.
All right. Okay. I'm gonna give it 6.5.
Great. You balance it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me why.
Okay. Two major differences. So let's bring up the book scene that I read from.
Yes.
I would have been happy for a 3-hour film and include that scene in the film.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Because we've watched a few reviews on the interweb, and people always bring up the dining room scene.
Super interesting.
Yeah, but they talk about why
that have been cast could hella act it.
Yeah, I get it, and like all the subtleties and all the like things that aren't being said. I get it. I find it really interesting that the reviewers we've been watching have been saying that it's not that big of a deal, that it's not there. But I agree.
I see what they're saying. So like,
but no, I agree with you that I would like to watch. I would like to see it.
A lot of reviewers have suggested that the reason it's cut is because they really focus on the exploitation of Chani and her people. And that's legit. That's a legit focus. There's this other interesting plot line, though, that I'm really fascinated with, where Sherbert. Is,
if you just said it as yes. Sherbert, yeah.
Oh, let's call him Frank Sherbert. So Frank Sherbert.
Nah, let's not do that.
Nah, I'm gonna do it. It's done now.
Okay.
Frank Sherbert. I just imagine like a human popsicle. But with popsicle stick arms sitting at a computer and typing out.
Just smashing the keys.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Just kind of like.
Well, there's a really
no,
big...
No, 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 no. Kind of like Olafing it. Like he's imagining what he would like to be in the desert. Sherbert in the desert.
I just had...
No, that's really funny. You have to acknowledge my funny joke.
He's imagining what he would be in the desert?
Because Olaf imagines what he would be like in the snow. And the Sherbert...
The sun.
Which is... Yeah, in the sun. In summer. And the sherbet, which is an ice cream popsicle, is imagining what it would be like in the desert.
So it's the same as Olaf.
Yeah, but one's a popsicle. And it's a climate.
Okay.
I'm sure, a season.
I bet they've made it's Olaf different. Popsicles.
Yeah.
Sherbet here is like a powder of sugar that has some sour in it. And it's like a little plastic tube and you just shot it. And it's, like, ridiculous. I don't know if you can even buy it anymore, because it's ridiculous.
Oh, I bet you can.
But there's something I really want to say, because the more we're talking about, the more I remember, right? There's a whole big subplot of Jessica being accused of being the traitor
in the house,
and that's not in there. Yeah.
And that's going to be interesting, because later, when Wee Boy, not Duncan Idaho, the other one,
I know who you mean. The one who runs off into the fire and flames.
Gurney Halleck.
Yeah. Gurney!
Gurney! My man. When Gurney sees Jessica, he tries to kill her.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe they'll just delete that.
Yeah, I just don't think that will happen.
Like they did with Sirius in the mirror.
Yes. I know what you're talking about.
Anyway. But there's this other much larger subplot about the ecology of the planet, which is why I wanted to read that section.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Yes, talk more about that.
So I'm going to just, like, this isn't really relevant to this adaptation because, you know, it's kind of comes up in the second half of the book. So it won't be until the next part of the film. Or our kittens are hardcore wrestling in a playful way.
Yeah.
Oh, they're so cute. They pretend to be grumpy, but they're not. They're playing.
I watched another YouTube video because I was worried about their fighting. And a sign that they actually would be fighting is if someone was like hiding under something as though they were actually afraid, which they're not doing, or going to like running away from each other to like keep their distance. But I think they equally engage with each other in fights as much as the other for different reasons.
Okay, I have to get this out. Ecology.
Yeah.
So this is a spoiler for parts of the end of the film. Not big parts, but this is a spoiler. So you can skip this part and still listen to the rest of the episode and it will make sense. But I'm just going to talk about this. So, the way that Jessica becomes a Sayadima, which he calls her in the film but isn't yet technically, is that she has to drink...
Is that what he calls her when he's like, you can't fight her?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, cool.
She has to drink the water that a worm has been drowned in and survive.
Yeah, it regurgitates it.
Yeah, that gives her prescience, like, stronger powers of clairvoyance.
Well, it also...
And she gets all the knowledge of all the Reverend Mothers.
Yeah. And her...
Right. So, but the thing is that...
Her baby.
If there was more water, the worms would die. So there's this question about whether or not it's right to terraform the planet, because Kynes is talking about terraforming the planet so that it's more sustainable for humans and there is no longer such a competition for water. But it also gets rid of the spice. So there's this massive subplot and this question that's not really answered by the series about whether or not it's right to terraform, because I know that's something that humans are looking at doing to prepare the way for a planet when we inevitably destroy this one.
Mars.
Yeah. So I'm a little bit sad that that seems to have been cut. I understand why it's been cut. The plot that they're focusing on is much more relevant, but
yeah,
I mean, they're both relevant. They're both interesting.
Oh, there's considering the density of this book, there is not a lot of wasted pages. So it's 583 thick pages.
And I wanted to see that scene because we lose a lot of the power of Jessica, which is my other number one complaint. Mm. I think Jessica is a sniveling, whiny crybaby in this film. In a way that she's not represented in the book. Yes, she cries when her husband dies, but for the rest of the book, she is stoic. She is concerned when Paul starts to come into his powers, for a lack of a better word, to describe what happens to him. Superpowers,
yeah. I was thinking about that.
But you get to see how clever she is and how she's reading the subtext of everyone in the room by watching their facial expressions and their body language and things like that. And I would have enjoyed seeing an actress as powerful as...
Rebecca Ferguson.
Yes.
As Lady Jessica. But yeah, she's also from The Greatest Showman. You're absolutely right. As is Zendaya.
Yeah.
Ah.
Yeah, there's a joke made in the Honest trailer about her putting white boy notches on her belt.
Yeah, Zendaya. Well, it's funny. What was I going to say? You just straight me with... Yes. Okay, I was thinking about Jessica's character, Lady Jessica, watching this and her emotionalness. Because she still is really powerful, right? Like, she is teaching Paul the voice and she, you know, gets the guards to kill each other and untie them when they're captured. And she also fights the Fremen leader.
Sadakar is the type of the army. It's Stilgar.
Right? So it's not like she doesn't have strength, but she does look very lost a lot. Like, because I don't want to portray that being emotional is weakness.
No, but...
But I do want to capture that. She isn't...
She seems too much like the blubbering wife.
Yeah.
In the beginning, when she's actually incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
Obviously, she is concerned when Paul is dealing with the Gom Jabbar and the box thing. But I would have liked to see sort of like that schism thing they sometimes do, where you get images of her, like cuts of her being stoic, like really quickly cut with little tiny clips of her being like freaking out.
Oh, I know.
And then a close up of just like her eye twitching.
Yeah. No, that's a really good idea.
As she says her mantra.
But with that, because those techniques are often used in like thrillers or psychological thrillers, so that would have changed the tone a little bit. Like this movie is very artistic in the way that it has like sweeping...
I think there's a way to make that artistic.
Sure. Yeah, but yeah, okay. I mean, I don't know, but yeah. Because this film is very, it's not slow, but because it's very intentional.
We get clips of, I mean, there's a lot of tension built around Paul putting his hand in the box.
Oh, yeah, like the shaking of the frame. Yeah, no.
And I feel like there could have been similar tension with Jessica, and then maybe her eye would twitch. Like, she'd maintain her composure and then her eye would twitch just as he releases it or something, you know?
Yeah, no, I totally get what you're saying.
Sorry, just Denis Villeneuve, if you had just consulted me, I could have helped you with this part. So, you know, your loss, but I'm on Twitter. He's not going to listen to this. It's fine.
No, I just still think it's funny.
Other differences that I didn't feel as significant about but wanted to see was the part where... Duke Leto before the dinner party. They're setting up for it, and one of the customs is that people dip their hands in a pot of water and intentionally slosh it to the floor. And then the maids wring them up with towels, and then the towels are brought outside for beggars to drink the water from the towels. And he gets rid of that custom. But he's really mad at the maid because he realizes that the maid probably would have sold the water. And he is kind of disgusted by the whole custom because it's degrading for the beggars. But he seems to be frustrated with the maid being upset at losing out on that coin. And I feel like that's one of those interesting nuances where Duke Leto comes in as like the good guy and could have been like a great opportunity for them to criticize that it's still sort of a white savior narrative by showing that white saviors are never going to know exactly this struggle, even if they have good intentions, because the woman, he's not looking after the woman who is a serf, essentially. She's a servant who wants to earn extra coin. She needs that. She probably needs that to survive as well. You know, they eke out a meager existence under the...
No, you're right. I mean, there should never really be emperors or kings or queens of anything.
Absolutely.
Like, it should all be a... Gross. What do you call it? A democratic republic? Is that true democracy?
No, true democracy would be where every vote gets a single count. So it's always... you would vote on everything.
All right, what we have now is a democratic republic.
Yeah, it's closer.
Okay.
To that.
Yeah.
So,
I like that.
Yeah, but
Do you think they portrayed it at all as though there was, like, a white savior issue going on?
I think they made Chani very strong.
Yeah.
And I'm glad they kept that strength and didn't make her, like, fawn over Paul. I don't think they did. I don't think they super acknowledged the white savior issues.
Yeah, I agree. What about making Dr. Kynes a black
woman? Still an outsider.
Yeah. Definitely.
So...
And isn't she Chani's mother?
Maybe her father? The story?
Yeah. Is Dr. Kynes...
It's K-E-Y-E-N-E-S.
Chani's...
Yes.
Yeah. So she was...
Good recall, babe.
Thank you. So that's really interesting, and I wonder if Chani knows that her mother is dead. Because her father's already dead.
I think she does find out in the book.
Yeah.
But she obviously didn't find out in this movie.
Yeah.
Another change.
They also might not have it that they have that relationship. Like, they might just not make that connection.
Another change that didn't come that's similar to the water towel situation was that there's a bonus that you get for sighting worms when you're out collecting
dust
and
spice.
dust is a different series.
That's a different thing.
And Duke Leto sights the worm in the scene with the copters, and he says to have it divvied among the other helicopters, and that was a change that was made because it just gets cut, and I feel like that could have easily been in there. Again, shows like that he is different from the Harkonnens, but maybe still a little bit misguided. And the other change in that scene was that the carryall is just missing. It's not broken, and it's implied that the Harkonnens paid off the captain of the carryall to be missing instead of broken, but they just showed it. And I think that makes sense. That kind of change makes sense to streamline the plot a little bit.
Yeah.
So this I was dialogue. Cool with that.
Yeah, for sure.
Cool.
Okay.
Other notes I had.
Yeah, you wrote brutal.
Oh, yeah. I just thought when Gurney Halleck is describing the Harkonnens in the beginning, he's like, they're brutal. I loved that line delivery. I was like, yeah, go on with yourself. Just commit. Oh, another change that I missed out on was that, so there's, we don't get as much the backstory for Gurney Halleck and Duncan Idaho and the two Mentats, and also Dr. Yue, who commits the act of treachery, but he clearly cares for Paul quite significantly.
What does he do, sorry?
Well, he sets up Paul to be saved.
Yeah.
Which is in the film. But he also gives Paul a Bible, which was an interesting part of the plot of the legend of the Cuisiaux Haderach being laid in among the Fremen. And he's able to quote, like, old text that's been, like, lost and stuff. And that's part of what helps build up him as the Muad'Dib.
Yeah.
So Muad'Dib. I was a little bit bummed that he didn't give him the Bible. Also, I just think that would have been a bit cool. And I can totally see Timothy Chalamet carrying, like, an old vintage leather Bible that's super tiny and just fingering lightly the little paper thin pages. Oh, totally. You know, like, I just read, like,
with his big collars.
Yeah.
And his gloves.
This is kind of moving into things I like. So I love the delivery of the line, Birdle. I loved the line that the Reverend Mother says. Goodbye, young human. I hope you live. Like, I just want to be able to deliver lines as brooding and ominous as
yeah,
that.
She just said it.
With as much nonchalance as she does.
Incredibly monotone.
Goodbye. Like, we all want that kind of power, you know?
Which is disregard. He's a small figure in her plot.
Such mana. honestly, I loved the symbolism and of the bull imagery that was woven through as sort of like a foreshadowing of Duke's kind of, the Duke's arrogance at thinking that he could overcome the trap that's been laid.
Yeah. Well,
like it's sort of like the bull is the plot.
Yeah.
And the dad's Duke Leto's dad is like, I can take on the bull. And the Duke Leto's like, I can take on the bull. But it's like Dune, and he can't.
Yeah, no. But I think it's a bit different, isn't it? Because in the book, we know that there is a traitor, but we don't know who it is. And so there's a bit more suspense built up about when they're going to be betrayed. Like,
it's never a question that he's going to die, though.
No, never. But the seeker, hunter seeker, like, there isn't... It's kind of like... the person has to be really, like, in the book, the person has to be really close to use it, and so there couldn't have been a Harkonnen, like, left.
Yeah, absolutely.
It, like, left there to do it themselves.
Well, but there was.
Yeah.
It's implied that he was buried in the walls. Ooh, I just farted. Can you hear that?
But for a while, it's, like, there's suspicion on, like, the maids or whoever... When it's Dr. Yue, of course, which is actually really interesting, because then he later saves Paul.
Yeah, because he cares about Paul. He's only being a traitor because his wife is being held by the
Harkonnens. So why was he going to kill him, and then he doesn't?
Kill who?
Paul.
He was never going to...
The Hunter Seeker was for Paul.
The Hunter Seeker was never supposed to kill Paul.
What was it supposed to do?
Set up... It was part of setting up the wife as... a potential
Lady Jessica.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Whereas I feel like,
and also to help them, like, reduce their guard, because if that's the best that you got, you know.
Yeah. If there's like, if you're not paying attention for a second though in the movie, you miss when Dr. Yue. Because the only reason they get attacked the way that they do is because he...
Brings down the shield wall. Yeah.
Which makes them vulnerable, so...
But that was always the plan. It was always the plan for it to happen like that. Paul was not supposed to die from the Hunter Seeker.
Yeah. Okay, good. Continue.
Obviously, the acting is stunning. The costume design is beautiful. Dune is beautiful. The worms are, like, gross and beautiful, and I love them.
They got
them.
Some big teeth!
You know, if I was, like, a really big Dune fan, and I do like Dune, but if I was a really big Dune fan, I would be perfectly happy to have a tattoo of that worm on my body.
Had you read it before? Did you know anything about Dune before we covered it?
I knew there were worms, and I knew there was a desert.
Yeah, because I saw the David Lynch film when I was quite, like, younger, because my dad's quite into sci-fi. So I knew about that before I had read the book. So my, like, when I read the book... I was imagining the characters from the 1984 film.
Of course.
And I always think about that because the guy who plays Paul in 1984, like, because the film came out when it did, in 1984, I know him much more as an adult, and I knew him the most from Desperate Housewives, when he's a like kind of crazy, jealous guy.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Bugsy! I really enjoyed the imagery that was used in the film. Obviously, this was a very visual story, but like I said, I
enjoyed the bowl. It was beautiful!
And I enjoyed the red handprint on Duke Leto's white shirt right before he dies, like he's being marked. And I enjoyed the burning of the palm trees, which are described as sacred earlier.
Yeah.
Because that is very allegorical with Christian ideology.
Mm, what a waste.
And that, yeah, what a way.
It upsets me because I'm like, all those people could have been drinking water because the trees died anyway.
Yeah. I'm really excited for Dune Part 2. I want to see how the story unfolds in the second half, and I really want to see Murderous Child.
Yeah. I really want to see...
I want to know who they're going to cast as a Murderous Child.
Yeah. And I... What... Sorry, I'm getting tired. And that's making my thoughts... all jumbled up.
Yeah.
Do you think
super sleepy
Dune could ever be made into a good film with only one part? Because I don't think so. Like, it is too complex.
It's too dense.
Yeah.
Like, if it was a 5-hour film, maybe.
Yeah. Well, that's the same as making two films. And there was a TV series, which we haven't watched, but I've also heard that that was a bit not good anyway.
Mm.
Have you noticed this whole episode I haven't sweared?
Well done.
For you.
Do you know what love? I'm really disappointed about?
What?
Biggest disappointment. I just really missed the great cube shields from the 1984 version. Oh my god, version.
Those giant pixels.
I'm just really disappointed that wasn't like just referenced at some point.
Well, I'll be really sad if like metallic underwear is left out of part two.
Right? We need that.
We need
it's
that.
It's essential.
It's iconic.
Yeah.
It's not in the book.
Or I would,
but it's iconic. what about this plot?
I would just even take like a teaser poster for the film where Siddhartha? No, that's not right.
No.
The son is it's played by the Guardians of the Galaxy guy, isn't it?
Well, it's charming, darling.
Gotta have some fun mouth noises or people will get bored.
Unique among sci-fi novels. No. I know nothing comparable to it except The Lord of the Rings, Arthur C. Clarke. Dune, the finest, most widely acclaimed and enduring science fiction novel of this century. Huge in scope, towering in concept, it is a work that will live in the reader's imagination. One of the landmarks of modern science fiction, an amazing feat of creation. Also available, Dune Messiah, Children of Dune, God Emperor of Dune, and Heretics of Dune. Dune seems to be the theme. Would you ride
Fade
a...
Rautha, not Siddhartha.
Yeah, Fade Rautha. Would you ride a sandworm if you could?
Yes.
Do you want something else that they left out of the film, Brianna? The subplot that the main bad Harkonnen, what's the ugly Harkonnen man's name, who's played by the father in Pirates of the Caribbean, who's turned into a barnacle. What's his name? The head Harkonnen.
Is the actor's name?
No, just his name.
Harkonnen? I want to say Vladimir, but that's not right.
Vladimir, it doesn't matter. You know the one I mean. He's a big guy. So I'm glad they left it out because it is a trope that happened a lot.
Pedophiles?
Yes.
Yeah, that, I mean, cut it. Yeah. Doesn't need to be in there.
Yeah, and I'm glad that, like, if you've read the book, it's an awkward bit to read these days.
I think...
this book...
I mean, I feel like it's probably, you know, true to his character. I wouldn't be surprised if someone with that much power did such things.
Well, he's a bad guy.
Sorry, I just want to say, what my point was...
Yes, sorry.
...is that I would even just accept a teaser poster of the actor playing Fade Rautha, who has not been officially determined, in a metallic underwear piece. Just a poster. It doesn't even have to be just a poster. Just a fun poster would be good. But it sounds like it could be
Harry Styles.
No. Wouldn't that be hilarious? No, the guy from Eternals.
So not Sting. What the heck was that, Shelley?
Barry Keoghan.
Which one was that? What power did he have? The one who can control the minds.
Yeah. I feel like he would be...
No, I feel like he'd be good.
You know, he's kind of got, like, Star Wars... what's his wee boy name?
Anakin?
No, wee emo boy in the new Star Wars.
Adam Driver?
Famous. Yeah, he's sort of got Adam Driver
vibes.
Yeah,
no, he does, he does. When do you think Frank Herbert was born?
1934.
1920, so he's an old man. It's 102 if he was alive.
Is he dead? Yeah. I feel like he's dead.
I don't think he's 102. And this was written in 1965, so he was 45 when he wrote Dune. So
I got time.
You got time, love. Do not be disheartened.
I'm good.
I'm good. I'm sleepy. But I'm glad we did this.
Really, really good visual imagery.
Yeah.
I kind of wish things like worms, sandworms existed.
I mean, if I could wish anything existed that was mystical or magical or science fiction, well, it wouldn't be a giant sandworm, I can tell you that much.
It's just...
Think about the world you would have to live on for that kind of animal to have an ecological sense, like a purpose. But a flying bison... Yeah,
they're really cool.
A flying bison... I would accept
them as existing on an alien planet where it can't reach me.
What about a flying bison, though?
Yes, I would obviously love a flying bison.
Well, I think we would all love a flying bison.
You know
bison.
What? No, actually, I wouldn't.
Why not?
Because humans would exploit them, and it would be horrible, and we'd have to see sad videos about
no!
it.
No! If we have a world of flying bison, we don't have those people. Although those people...
we don't have those
Although
people.
Those people are in The Last Airbender, where they have that zoo, so... Yeah. Why have you ruined my dream?
I'm sorry.
You suck.
You gave a sad one-word summary of Dune. It's your own fault.
One sentence, not one word.
How would you rate Dune? Oh, desert. drugs.
Dune.
How would you rate Dune as a film in and of itself?
Like an 8?
Yeah. I'd watch it again.
Yeah.
If I'm feeling that vibe.
But also, like... It's not something that I crave to watch. Like,
I don't crave watching really good films.
No.
I crave watching really shitty films that help me forget about the world.
I watched High School Musical again last week.
Yeah.
I'm in my 29th year of life. And I still can't get over the development of Zac Efron as a human. Like, he is so different now than who he was when he was 17 years old.
Are you basing that off of his portrayal of Troy Bolton in High School Musical, or are you basing that off of interviews you've seen?
I just
when he
mean
was 17?
His physique.
Okay, sure, yeah.
Yeah, like he was still pretty fit, but like.
Pressures. The pressures for body physicality are there for men and women in Hollywood these days.
Yeah, that's something I've noticed about Charmed.
Let's make everyone have some sort of body dysmorphia. Wouldn't that be fun? We can sell them lots of products and make them feel sad.
Wow, we should do the marketing campaign. Yeah. That's what I've noticed about Charmed, is that the three sisters are obviously gorgeous and...
stupidly thin.
Some stupidly thin. But the men are, like, quite average looking. Like, the Page's love interest, he just had such an average body.
Yeah.
But at the time, that would have been the standard. But the standards... have changed a lot in that time. Like, you know, Gal Gadot is kind of the peak feminine ideal in Hollywood these days in some regards. We've also got people like Margot Robbie.
Yeah.
She's pretty A-lister these days.
I think there is a lot.
And men is like Chris Hemsworth, like big, bulky, like strong men like The Rock and stuff, you know? Like, men are big these days. It's not like, like if you watch the Batman, people will know what I mean by that sound.
Val Kilmer
is the name of a famous actor. But if you look at that Batman portrayal, he's not buff at all. And that's actually what they're, like, Robert Pattinson has said the same thing, that he didn't beef up to play Batman. Because you don't have to be super buff to be strong or fight, which is absolutely true.
Hmm.
Valkyrie. Yeah, I can't remember. Anyway, that's my brain switching off for the night.
Yeah, we don't have remake, revamp, or retire because they're still part two, so we can't effectively say what we would feel.
Absolutely, and this is also a remake.
Yes.
So,
at this point, I'm hopeful that this could be
the start of something new. It feels so right to be watching Dune. Oh, yeah. Nice twist. I like that.
Cool.
Yeah, no, we'll have to wait for part two and then we'll do another episode. But what are we doing after this, Brie?
Tipping of the Velvet, just by Sarah Waters.
Just Tipping the Velvet. So Brie and I are changing up the format of the podcast a bit.
Yes, we should talk to that.
We've both gotten even busier, if you can believe it. This time it's like, with our careers.
Yeah, let's say we haven't gotten busier socially or with artsy projects, but Maddie and I have both started amazing new jobs,
which are tiring.
And also, the podcast has always been something we do for fun, for the love of reading and looking at how books are portrayed visually. And
people's interpretation of them.
I really enjoy that, but I also really enjoy reading other kinds of books.
Yeah, I've just started The Wheel of Time again. I'm really excited. And also reading The Chrysalids, which is really fun.
And now I have to also add in some more young adult novels so that I can adequately recommend stories to my students.
Oh, you don't even lie. You've read plenty of YA.
But not modern YA. Bugsy,
say hi. You can't see him because he's no...
I have to come up with a way to tolerate modern YA novels' obsessions. Modern YA novelists' obsession with the simile.
We're also reading Skullduggery at the moment. We've got a lot of books on the go. And that's good. That's good.
And I'm reading Children of Blood and Bone. Yeah. And so just to...
So our point is that we read a lot at once.
Well, our point is that we need to be able to read for fun as well as for the podcast. So we are only going to be releasing one episode a month going forward. We might do some specials here and there of like children's adaptations and stuff, but
yeah.
In addition to that, we are not going to be so rigid with season subjects. So we had just started like a dystopian one, but we actually really enjoyed the diversity that we got from the
season two
strong female lead. So we're going to be aiming more for looking at a diverse range of stories by diverse voices representing diverse people.
Yeah, so we're doing Tipping the Velvet by Sarah Waters because it's gay AF! When I was a young budding lesbian, like 14, 15, and I didn't really have, well, I didn't have any gay friends and I didn't know what I was or who I was or what my face should be. No. I was very much, you know, I didn't have any identity because I'm too malleable. As an adult, I'm becoming more firm of who I am as a person. But when I was that age, I was very as most 14-year-olds are, to be honest. But I just speed through these books because I was like, ooh, they're gay. I'm super gay. But, you know, so they were really helpful for me because they made me feel less alone. And they had a bit of raunchiness in them.
Yes, I am looking forward to the saucy details.
Yeah, they are saucy, so that will be what we're doing.
I
mean, next.
I read Red, White, and Royal Blue, and there was some. You read it too, didn't you?
Yeah,
we listened to it. Of course, some saucy details in that book.
Yeah, this one's even more.
Even more.
This is an
saucy.
Adult one.
Ooh.
This is adult.
I don't know if I can handle it.
You'll love it.
Great. Hope that all of our listeners are okay with that and can respect that we're just trying to keep that work-life balance. Because, you know...
It's life-work balance, man. Yeah. Life comes first, man.
Life comes first.
Yeah.
Say that really mockingly, but it should come first. So yeah. We still want to do the podcast, and this is a way to do it and enjoy our lives.
And keep our mental health.
Ooh, and maybe we could have a very special crossover episode coming up soon. We'll tease that a bit later.
Cool. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Chapter 1, Take 2. Feel free to email us, chapter1take2@outlook.com. We have a Facebook, Instagram. You can reach us. If you have the internet, you can reach us. Unfortunately, unless you live in Aotearoa without the internet, you cannot reach us unless you come here physically. And that might be a little bit scary for us, to be honest. Not going to lie.
Mm.
Yep. These days, millennials and Gen Zs, we do not like unannounced visitors. Don't even call us, like... send a message. We only call each other if something horrible has happened.
Do you know what? Send an owl before you
send
a text.
Oh my god, send an owl! Please! Please send an owl!
We would also accept monkey or dragon.
Yeah.
Mouse.
A dragon that could talk. Anyway.
Okay.
Take care and we'll talk to you next time.
Singing Ghost Graham.
Yeah. Ka kite.
Ka kite.
I know. Yes.